Good morning. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich.
And I'm Chris Vanderpool.
It's a Monday, May 6th from HPR2. It's The Conversation, a highly inappropriate gift for Mother's Day.
The novel behind the shoji screen.
Mary Jane, You Don't Wear or Smoke.
An artist's not-so-secret garden.
The BBC has today's global report. We've got a million-dollar backyard quiz. What happens when a senator's private reserve for a charity dries up in the reality check, too? First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Lakshmi Singh. Prosecutors and defense attorneys will ask a federal judge at a hearing this hour to release on bail one of the three men accused of helping Boston Marathon bombing suspect Jahar Tsarnaev after the bombing. NPR's Craig Windham reports prosecutors initially said Robel Filipos should be held without bond to keep him from fleeing.
Now, after conferring extensively with his defense attorneys, prosecutors have agreed that Filipos can be released under strict conditions. He'll have to post a $100,000 bond, remain confined at the home of a third-party custodian, and wear an electronic monitoring bracelet. The agreement and conditions must be approved by a judge. Filipos is accused of lying to federal agents and denying that he knew about the removal of a backpack from Tsarnaev's college dorm room. Lawyers for Filipos say he visited that room after the bombing by sheer coincidence and bad luck. They describe their client as a frightened and confused 19-year-old. Craig Windham, NPR News.
Authorities say they have foiled what they're calling a localized terror attack in the western Minnesota city of Montevideo. 3 days after arresting Buford Rogers, the FBI says it uncovered suspected pipe bombs, Molotov cocktails, and firearms at a mobile home. NATO says new questions about chemical weapons use in Syria make it even more urgent for UN inspectors to investigate. Terry Schultz reports the alliance is warning both sides such use would be a violation of international law.
UN human rights investigator Carla Del Ponte says she has testimony indicating the rebel side has used sarin gas, but her claims have not been backed up by an investigation and the U.S. casts doubt on them. NATO chief Anders Fogh Rasmussen adds that NATO suspects chemical weapons have been used in Syria, but that he doesn't have enough evidence to point to the perpetrators. He criticizes the Syrian government for blocking access to UN inspectors who could find out what's happened.
It's regrettable that so far the Syrian authorities have denied the United Nations such access.
Rasmussen reminds that no matter who uses chemical weapons, it's a violation of international law. For NPR News, I'm Terry Schultz in Brussels.
Heavy machinery is still digging through debris of concrete and metal in Dhaka, Bangladesh, where at least 645 bodies have been pulled from the rubble of the Rana Plaza building. The garment factory collapsed nearly 2 weeks ago, prompting global outcry from governments demanding stronger safety oversight of Bangladeshi manufacturers. The owner of the Rana Plaza building has been arrested. At last check on Wall Street, Dow Jones Industrial Average up 12 points at 14,986, NASDAQ up 16, and the S&P 500 gaining 5. This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the Pajamagram Company, offering women's pajamas in gift packaging delivered overnight and for Mother's Day at pajamagram.com.
This is The Conversation on HPR 2. I'm Chris Vanderkuhl.
I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. According to the CDC, anyone who's sexually active can get gonorrhea. It's a common sexually transmitted disease, and of the over 800,000 annual U.S. cases, almost 600,000 occur in teens and young adults in their early 20s. The garden variety is treatable. What has grabbed headlines since 2011 are strains of drug-resistant gonorrhea, including the highly resistant and possibly untreatable H041. After last week's concern that the super gonorrhea bug might be in Hawaii, we asked Chief of STD AIDS Prevention, Peter Whitaker, to school us. Good morning.
Hi, Bethann. Good to be with you.
Well, good to talk about this because it seems we really need to. There was a while when there was a lot of information about STDs out there, and it seemed that awareness was growing, and then it seemed that it sort of fell back a little bit. And yet we know, you know, chlamydia is pretty rampant. It's out there a lot. So is gonorrhea. One makes you a little bit more predisposed to the other and to HIV. And we thought we had a lot of information about this, Peter. So what happened?
You know, I think there was a lot of focus on HIV and AIDS for many years. And because people changed their behavior, took more precautions, by reducing HIV, people were actually reducing the rates of STDs as well. And with the change in HIV, with better medications, we don't see people with HIV and AIDS around so obviously. And I think behavior has returned to what it was before, more risk behavior, and also the rates of STDs are increasing. In Hawaii, particularly for chlamydia, as you mentioned, the highest rates are in young women 15 to 19 years of age. So we know for sure our young people are having sex, are having unprotected sex, and are at risk. Now, the recent super sex bug that you referred to, which is clearly not in Hawaii or in the United States, I think has helped raise consciousness a little bit that STDs are here in Hawaii. And gonorrhea is certainly one of our concerns.
I mean, maybe we should be, in a way, grateful, Peter, that we had a reason to talk about this. Not that we'd wish anybody to be infected, but the fact that we have this, particularly in such a young age group, I mean, those who are 15 to 24 nationally, and we can sort of extrapolate right. That's happening here, too. These are also kids who are extremely, you know, wired into information that perhaps a generation or two ago was not as easily accessible and acceptable to go off and find to be able to talk about. I mean, now you don't even have to talk to anybody else. All you have to do is go on your, you know, your smartphone.
Yeah, I think information is there for those that want to find it. But, you know, one of the things we clearly know about sexual behavior is information and behavior are not directly linked. And I think there's a lot more work to do working with young people, with their parents and young people, with their community, in peer marketing, sharing information in social networking, that young people are at risk.
So more of that issue of, oh, it couldn't happen to me, that must be for somebody else.
I think that's true. There's a lot of denial in young people and to some degree to older people as well, because we see sexually transmitted diseases in all age groups. The recommendation is that young women under 25 be screened every year for STDs, and that's because often STDs are asymptomatic. And what that means is they don't have symptoms. And that does not mean because you don't have symptoms you don't have it, but the virus continues to grow and live in your body. And the long-term impacts can be pelvic inflammatory disease and ultimately infertility, which would be a great surprise later in life if you're trying to have children and you find that you cannot have children. The other thing that we're concerned about is STDs like chlamydia and gonorrhea can increase the likelihood of acquisition or transmission of HIV. And we're starting to hear less and less about HIV now because the drugs are more effective, we continue to have new infections of HIV in Hawaii and, of course, across the country.
But as part of the informational, you know, blast out to people to be more concerned about this, also realizing that as they might believe that gonorrhea is simply treatable, even if that were to happen, that's not the case anymore. And changing that mindset seems to be a little bit more difficult.
Well, it's true that gonorrhea still is treatable, but it's getting more difficult to treat. And I think that's really one of the major messages that over the years, the commonly used medications, you remember penicillin, tetracycline, Cipro, are no longer used for gonorrhea because they're no longer effective. The virus has mutated and there's now resistant strains. When we stopped using azithromycin just last year in 2011, that was one of the last classes of medications that can effectively treat gonorrhea. And that's why there's so much concern now, because the last class that we're using now, if the virus mutates, we will potentially be without effective medication for gonorrhea.
Which is pretty scary, because the choices have been steadily narrowing over time. Now you're down to one class of drugs.
That's right, and we're currently using multiple medications, so it's a small cocktail of medications. And when we look into the future, that's what when we look at this super sex bug again, that maybe is a little bit of a picture of what's going to happen in the future if we don't come up with new medications. CDC, NIH, and scientists are working to develop new medications, but in the meantime, we need people to practice prevention. We need people to be screened, and for physicians and for patients, if they do have gonorrhea, if they are diagnosed and they're treated, and if they're not successfully treated, to let their doctors know, because that's an indication that they may have one of those more resistant strains of gonorrhea. And it's incredibly important that we identify that and make sure that the disease does not continue to spread.
Now, speaking of spreading, though, when people travel frequently and they may engage in some vacation behavior that they wouldn't necessarily do at home and may bring something home that they wish they hadn't brought home to a partner. Do we need to do a much better job of educating people about what is really happening abroad? And just because they're an American or they may know better or they don't do this ordinarily, I mean, people will do some pretty wacko things when they're not on their home turf.
No, I think that's true. And also tourists, perhaps when they're here in Hawaii, I think really it comes down to individual behavior, whether it's in Hawaii or it's externally or in other countries. It's really about our behavior, where we are. And I think we need to be careful of the mentality that disease or infections are coming from somewhere else. Often the infections that are spreading are spread right here among us here in Hawaii.
Peter, thank you for coming in.
Good to see you.
Peter Whitaker has been chief of the STD AIDS Prevention Branch of the Department of Health since 1994. He serves on the National Alliance of State and Territorial AIDS Directors Executive Committee. The organization administrates HIV, AIDS, and viral hepatitis healthcare prevention, education, and supportive service programs funded by state and federal governments. For more information about the different strains of gonorrhea, go look at our website, hawaiipublicradio.org. This is The Conversation on member-supported HPR 2. Next up, your quiz, and later, Monday Coffee Talk and Shogun Proof to perform in this theater. Cue the chant.
The story behind today's backyard quiz begins with an extinct bird species endemic to the Big Island called the mamo. Mamo were small black honey creepers with curved beaks that helped them feed on nectar. But not all their feathers were black. Each mamo had from 6 to 8 gold-yellow feathers tucked behind their wings, and they were considered extremely valuable to native Hawaiians. So valuable, in fact, that in 1779, the naturalists aboard the HMS Discovery found that it was taboo to collect them if you weren't connected to Hawaiian royalty. So what made them valuable? For native Hawaiians, feathers are more than just beautiful. They symbolized rank and a connection to the gods. One of the most famous feather pieces is the cape of King Kamehameha I. 12 feet wide at its base and weighing 6 pounds, it was valued by the art critic J.J. Jarvis at $1 million in the mid-1800s. The cape is composed entirely of feathers, mostly the beautiful golden mamo feathers. And for today's quiz, can you guess how many feathers are in the cape?
Well, we're starting another week, and on Mondays, Bill Sage turns up in a morning spot somewhere on Oahu. Today, he's at the Waimanalo Beach Cafe and Gallery checking out the coffee and the conversation. So what's brewing, Bill?
Good morning. Good morning, Bethann. Yes, at the Waimanalo Beach Cafe, we have a wide range of topics and three people who have opinions about such wide topics. We're starting off with Dean Kelly, and Dean, you're interested today in expressing opinions on guns. Well, go ahead, shoot.
Well, thank you very much. It's nice to be able to say something. I am a little concerned. Our national conversation these days is guns, and there's a real polarizing, I think, on both sides. And I wish we could speak a little more civilly to one another and not speak from such polar positions. We have a problem. Guns are dangerous. A lot of things are dangerous. We regulate a lot of things that are dangerous. If it were up to me, I think I'd start with an idea of changing the verbiage. We call it gun control. And I really would like to call it gun management. We manage all sorts of things in our lives, and to me that makes more sense, and it maybe hopefully ratchets down the rhetoric a bit. I'd like to reframe it in that way.
For example, gun management. We have so many laws on the books. Perhaps managing what we already have and start using a rational plan of this is what we got. Why aren't you doing what you should?
We start with that, obviously, but we always have to think of what else is needed. Our laws are not perfect, and times change, ideas change, and certainly the number of people with guns change. So,
thank you very much, Dean, and that's one way to look at it, so make sure you come to the conversation unarmed and non-dangerous, but rational. Speaking of rational people, here we are. We're all unarmed at the table, and Barbara Eberhardt is here, and she has a really interesting idea on making the world a better place, and it does not involve weapons. It involves creativity.
Hi, yes, I am Barbara Eberhardt, and my belief is that guns don't kill people. People kill people, and people who have issues that they aren't able to express. I'm an artist, and one of my passions, my big passion, is being able to express yourself on a two-dimensional surface where no side effects. You don't have dead people. You don't even have a hangover. You get a natural high that really works for me. People in my art classes say that they have the most focused, happy, peaceful hour and a half of their whole week when they're in my class, and I'm a big believer in creativity as a way to have joy.
Thank you very much, Barbara Eberhardt. Let the record show we don't use paintball guns in that class, too. And last up, we have Lori Fried. Lori, you have a way of making the world a better place with yoga, is that correct?
Well, I try. I think yoga is a place to bring people to their center or to their true self, and if everyone's acting from their true self, we're all the same in that way, and so we'll all come together and be able to come up with solutions, managing them, as was said in the first discussion.
Thank you very much, Lori. In other words, if we can manage ourselves, we might manage to make the world a better place. And we'll try to continue to make the world a better place by doing such things as finding out what you want to find out about. For example, next week we'll find out at the Beach Bum Cafe, so keep sipping the coffee and keep those frontal lobes percolating. Bill Sage, back to you in the studio.
Thanks, Bill. We'll talk to you next week.
Back in the early days of novels, before the form was quite respectable, they masqueraded as collections of letters or diary entries, advancing the narrative from the perspective of the book's different characters. It's a very effective way to tell a story, one that offers the advantage of several different points of view on a single narrative arc. It's a method that author Pearl Besserman has chosen to evoke a time of upheaval in Japan's history, the first decades of the 19th century. Her novel is Kabuki Boy, and she's with us this morning. Good morning, Pearl.
Good morning, Chris.
This was a pretty turbulent time, and it occurs to me, and it's set in the theater in a very turbulent time, and it made me think that frequently the arts at a time of upheaval are very vital. Do you think that's accurate in this case?
I think in this case, particularly, because the Kabuki Theater arose pretty much the way Shakespeare's theater did, as a reflection and even an influence on the events that were extremely significant in the changing
of Japanese society. The period of the kabuki theater, the height of the kabuki theater, was early 19th century. And it evolved out of basically street performances that were originally seen in a very low form. For example, people dancing at the riverbanks, people putting on busking performances in the streets, telling stories in the streets. And it eventually coalesced into a very elaborate theatrical form, which aristocrats were supposed to avoid because it was intended basically for the hoi polloi. Mm-hmm. It was not a very high literary or spiritual or aristocratic art form the way, say, the No Theater was. It evolved in a great spurt at one moment in history because of the evolution of society downward from the aristocrats setting all this, this actual ways of behavior, the tastes, the cultural tastes, the refined cultural tastes. This all was passed on to what was called the class of chonin, the merchant classes. The merchant classes who became very, very powerful because it was they who held control of the finances. And even the samurai had to come to them for money lending. Even they had to come to them for rice because they became the holders of the economy, basically.
And with that social change, a whole new category of people had a voice.
A whole new category of people had a voice, and a whole new, excuse me, a whole new category of tastes evolved.
Mm-hmm.
And the tastes of the chonin were very different from those of the aristocrats. Very similar to Shakespeare's theater, in which the hoi polloi, usually standing up in the stalls, were the ones who called the shots. They were the kinds of people who you see in mosh pits today, who are very much part of the show. And what they wanted, what they demanded, was a lot of sex, violence, a lot of action. And they had no patience for the very sophisticated, long, slow, spiritual stories of the No Theater. So they got what they wanted. And it got ramped up as the theater became more and more successful, as the companies started competing with each other for success. The shows became more and more spectacular.
Mm-hmm.
So I would very much liken it to today, where you have more and more popular kinds of success, commercial kinds of success. And we even have situations there where actors became so famous the way celebrities are today.
Mm-hmm. They're just idolized.
They were so idolized that people started wearing their kinds of clothes. They put their same kinds of makeup on.
There's a reference to one of your characters where people are waiting for weeks to have a drink with him.
Oh, yes. It was not just fans, but priests who would come
and
around.
To be seen with one of these people. Well, you also have the thing in the recreating a popular legend. You have at one point in the plot, there's concern that this recreation of the popular legend is going to have a subversive political text to it, and then invite the anger of the authorities, right?
Oh, that happened on a regular basis.
Yeah,
the theaters were closed. It was censorship was rife, obviously, and I'm reminded of something very similar that happened in our own period when Shostakovich played certain kinds of music, and I think it was Lady Macbeth of the Steps. And Stalin took this very much to heart as a criticism of his own government and of himself, and shut down Shostakovich from playing from that point on. And this goes on through all of history, as you know.
Sure.
But it was very, very dangerous, particularly for theater companies in Kyoto and in Edo, which were the two, which is Edo is the old word for Tokyo.
It really makes a theater company a wonderful way to look at the society, doesn't it?
Yes, and it also puts the people in the theater company in a position of power that they otherwise would not have, because these were considered to be the dregs of society.
Yeah. Well, it's a terrific look at a world that I think very few of us would know much about. And thanks very much for coming on the show this morning.
Thank you for having me.
Pearl Besserman is the author of Kabuki Boy. She'll be speaking at the Hawaii Book and Music Festival Sunday, May 19th at 3 o'clock. And you can learn more from our HPR website.
Support for The Conversation comes from Pineapple Tweed Public Relations and Marketing, a boutique firm dedicated to providing clients passion, expertise, creative thinking, and execution.
Talk of the Nation provides you with the day's news and more, the experiences and opinions of people around the country and around the world. I'm Neil Conan. When you're looking for the latest news and how it affects you, your family, your neighbors, and your life, turn to Talk of the Nation from NPR News.
Weekday mornings from 9 to 11, right after The Conversation.
It has been a good 5 years for some lobbyists and certain charities. Lobbyists gave more than $1 million in donations to organizations favored by the late Hawaii Senator Dan Inouye. It's one way they curry favor, but they also save the control tower at Pearl Harbor and help the Pacific Aviation Museum, among other local projects. CivilBeat.com reporter Chad Blair joins us for today's reality check. Good morning.
Good morning, Beth Ann.
We don't really talk a lot about this, you know, these lobbyist donations to charities in honor of Senator Inouye, but it really illustrates another and perhaps far less considered aspect of his loss, you know, a smaller Inouye cliff, but one that charities may well feel.
And people in Hawaii, too, the total figure over the last 5 years, $1.275 million donations made by lobbying groups in Inouye's name and to a number of projects here in Hawaii. You mentioned the control tower at Pearl Harbor. You know, that's where the air raid Pearl Harbor, this is no drill, went out when the Japanese planes attacked in 1941. So it's a pretty big deal. They helped them raise over $100 million at the Pacific Aviation Museum. But another thing to keep in mind here is you're still buying influence. You're giving money on behalf of a senator to curry favor, as you indicated, because you want defense contracts awarded to your business.
I mean, Inouye was of particular importance to lobbyists. I mean, he's ranked 12th in drawing honoree donations
right.
in 2009 and 10, and it wasn't just because they were trying to be nice guys.
That's exactly right. I mean, a number of the companies, the lobbyists, are defense contractors. Raytheon, Lockheed Martin, Northrop Grumman alone kicked in $100,000 to help out with a number of causes of interest to the late senator. So in a sense, I suppose it's a win-win. They're getting what they want, but we're also getting some help here in Hawaii. I should mention another group that received help, the Kauai Economic Development Board here, also something that the senator focused on, Pearl Harbor, Arizona Memorial. As you know, he was a decorated war veteran.
I mean, a lot of his pet projects were given money simply because they were his pet projects, which may leave a lot of these organizations wondering what they're going to do now. Any indication of sort of where else they're shooting some focus, or where these lobbyists are now moving? Are they, in fact, going to bring any money to Hawaii at all?
That's a very good question. You know, Senator Akaka didn't get anywhere near as much of this kind of money compared to what Senator Inouye received. Of course, Senator Inouye, a very influential figure over the last half century. So, yes, as you mentioned, the Inouye Cliff. This is a smaller cliff, a hill, if you will, but something that will have significant impact on the islands.
And a lot of these organizations are left wondering, what is Plan B? Thanks, Chad.
Sure. Anytime, Beth Ann.
Chad Blair is a political reporter for CivilBeat.com.
This is Hawaii Public Radio, and this is The Conversation on HPR 2. I'm Chris Vandercook. Coming up, doing the Golden Mamo, a safe haven for an unplanned pregnancy, and for today's international news, the BBC World Report.
BBC News with Jonathan Izard. A United Nations investigation team says it has no conclusive findings on the use of chemical weapons in Syria by any side in the conflict. It made the statement after one of the team, Carla Del Ponte, said there was evidence, although not yet incontrovertible proof, that Syrian rebels had used chemical weapons. At least 15 people have died and many more have been injured in a blast at an election rally in northwest Pakistan. The bombing of a right-wing religious party in Khurram is the latest in a series of attacks linked to the general election, which is due to be held on Saturday. The German authorities have arrested a 93-year-old man who is accused of being a guard at the Auschwitz Nazi death camp. Hans Lipschitz admits to having served with the SS at the camp, but says he was only a cook. The veteran Italian politician Giulio Andreotti has died at the age of 94. He was Prime Minister seven times. His almost continuous presence on the political scene in Italy earned him the name Eternal Giulio, but his later career was overshadowed by allegations of links to the mafia. The International Monetary Fund says Greece is making progress in overcoming deep-seated economic problems, describing its efforts as exceptional. But the IMF says Greece still faces major challenges, particularly in dealing with tax evasion. The International Criminal Court has postponed the trial of Kenya's Deputy President William Ruto, who's accused of crimes against humanity. Mr. Ruto's lawyers had requested more time to prepare his defence. He denies the charges. Football's world governing body FIFA has provisionally suspended an executive committee member accused of fraud. Chuck Blazer is alleged to have embezzled millions of dollars during his time at a regional football organisation. He has previously denied any wrongdoing. And a violent storm has hit the Brazilian city of Rio de Janeiro. There's widespread disruption of the city's transport system with flooded roads and falling trees causing traffic jams. Large parts of Rio have suffered power failures. BBC News.
Tonight at 5, it's The Body Show with Dr. Kathy Kozak. And Kathy, for a long time, people have tended to look at arthritis as something they're just going to have to put up with. Has that changed?
Well, it hasn't necessarily changed, but we're going to talk today about some early innovations that people can consider. There are new supplements that people use. There are some exercises people can do. And we're going to talk about how can you preserve your joints the way they are now. And then we'll talk about what's up and coming in the world of orthopedics to try and treat some of these problems so we don't have to rush to getting new joints all the time.
Does frequent exercise do them good?
Absolutely. Some people think, hey, if I have arthritis, I really shouldn't go walking because my knee hurts, when in fact that may be the best thing for them.
So if you keep the joints supple, that gives you a fighting chance?
Well, it'll definitely give you a fighting chance. Keep them moving, keep yourself going, and we'll talk about some other tricks of the trade with one of our orthopedic experts today.
How about supplements, Kathy?
That's one of the things that, you know, it's been somewhat controversial. Some groups have shown that supplements do a great job. Other groups have said they really don't do much. So we're going to tease out the real truth behind some of those studies and figure out if somebody wants to take a supplement, what's the chances it's going to help and which one would be best?
So there are supplements that are subject to conflicting conclusions on some of these studies?
Absolutely. One of the biggest ones that people have heard about is glucosamine.
Yeah.
Some studies say it's great. Others say, why bother? So we're going to talk about why there was such a difference in the research community about these sorts of supplements.
That's an intriguing question in and of itself, isn't it, Kathy?
Well, it is, because, you know, there's got to be something we can do. And if there's a way to help the joints so that they don't go through age-related decline, and certainly any faster than they have to, then that's something that everybody wants to start now. And it's never too late. So we're going to talk about, even if you have arthritis, what could you do right now to keep your joints healthy?
Great, Kathy. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
That's The Body Show with Dr. Kathy Kozak tonight at 5.
HPR listeners who are also members recognize the vital connection between their support and the station's health. Mahalo to Gerald Durkin of Haiku, Maria DeMarco of Hilo, and Lee Schaller of Honolulu for their membership gifts. Many members prefer the convenience of giving monthly through the station's lifetime membership program. Choose the amount you want to give, adjust it at any time in the future, and you'll be secure in knowing that you've done your part. Information and a downloadable gift form are at hawaiipublicradio.org. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. It's 8:35. This is The Conversation on statewide, member-supported HPR2.
Aloha, I'm Dave Lawrence, and this is Stargazer, our weekly guide of what to look for in our island skies. We're joined by Sean Lotch from the Emilo Astronomy Center in Hilo, our official conduit to the research community atop Mauna Kea. Aloha, Sean. What are some of the things we'll be looking for in our week of stargazing?
Aloha, Dave. Greetings from Mauna Kea. New moon takes place on Thursday this week, so look for the moon over the weekend right after sunset in the western sky. Sunday, look for Jupiter and the moon as they make a nice pair in the western sky at sunset, and Saturn will continue to get higher in the sky in the east.
Anything unusual happening over the week?
This week, there's a partial solar eclipse here in Hawaii on Thursday. Now, solar eclipses can only take place during the new moon, and we've already mentioned new moon on Thursday, of course. The eclipse is annular one from the South Pacific, but here we only get to see a partial eclipse. Now, safety is the key thing, because you can damage your eyes if you're not careful. Do not, I again repeat, do not look directly at the sun with your unaided eye, because it can do damage. The safest way is to do something called a projection method. Look at a pinhole, and you don't look at the sun, but you project it on the ground through the pinhole and view what's happening with the sun. The eclipse will start at 2:32 in the afternoon, with a maximum at 3:47, where basically, through that pinhole, it will look like someone's taken a bite out of the sun, and with about 44% of the sun covered. The eclipse will end at 5:03 p.m. Again, be safe when looking at this, because you don't ever want to damage your eyes. So Thursday afternoon, again, pinhole projection, the best way. If you look up pinhole projection for solar eclipses on the web, you'll see tons of sources for that.
Good tip. Finally, anything on the ISS Tiangong 1 X-37B sort of thing?
Definitely. Tonight, you can see the X-37B from 7:08 to 7:14 p.m., moving from northwest to southeast. Saturday, see International Space Station from 5:11 to 5:18, moving from southwest to east. And you can see it again on Sunday morning from 4:22 to 4:27 a.m., moving from south to northeast.
Mahalo for the report, Sean. We appreciate it.
Mahalo for having me, Dave.
You are quite welcome. Sean Lotch, Emilo Astronomy Center on the Big Island, and I'm Dave Lawrence. We will catch you next time here for Stargazer.
Later today, the alleged mother of the baby supposedly found at Sandy Beach will face a custody hearing. Not many details have been released, including why she just didn't leave the infant at a police or fire station or a hospital without the Sandy Beach story, or why she didn't seek other alternatives when she found out she was pregnant. Another young woman, who was also once alone and pregnant, is asking that question too. Jenna joins us now. Thank you for coming in.
Oh, no problem. Good morning.
I'm going to ask you to move a little bit closer to the mic so that we can hear your story a little bit.
Okay.
You are a little older than the 21-year-old who is going to find out what her fate with her baby may be later on today.
Correct.
You, forgive me for putting it in this way, but you got involved with a guy who you thought was wonderful and found out you'd been snookered by a married man.
Yes, exactly. You never think something like that will happen to you until you're faced dead on with it. He ended up not only being deceptive about that aspect of his life, but his name and what he did for a living as well. He seemed like the nicest guy in the world, like, you know, somebody that you could have a really good time with and really enjoy, you know, spending your day with. And
in your case, making it a life with, potentially.
Yeah.
Now, I mean, you're older than this young woman who is wrapped up in the baby Sandy case.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, forgive me for saying that you're over 30. And
I don't mind saying it. I'm 35.
All right, fine. I was going to let you do that. I mean, far be it from me. One would think that at that point in your life and maturity that you might not have been easily taken in, but kind of proof of the fact that you can be willingly led down the path of disbelief if that's what you choose to do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. I guess I would caution women in this day and age, and especially because, you know, this is such a cosmopolitan area, to be really vigilant and aware. No matter how nice someone seems, I mean, always do a background check. But, you know, these situations can happen regardless.
But doing a background check, though, some people hear those words, background check, and have no idea what that means. What would you advise?
Go online, and, you know, it's a small fee that you can pay to look up someone's history. I think maybe about $35. But, I mean, if you're very interested in someone, then it's more than worth it to save you a lifetime of, I guess, not have known, you know, that something like that could happen. I wish that I would have done it. It would have changed my situation. I'm very happy with the fact that I have a son and I love him to death. But, you know, things might have been a little less traumatic for me.
But what you did do, though, I mean, you did have the presence of mind once you found out that you were pregnant to go online and look for options mm-hmm. and look for alternative, which is how you came upon the Mary Jane program from Catholic Charities Hawaii.
Mm-hmm. Yes, definitely. I just thought that there probably was resources out there for women like myself, and turns out that there are, and even a lot more than I knew about at the time. Even after finding Mary Jane Home, I thought that was the only one, but apparently there are several on the island. The difference with Mary Jane Home is that it's privately funded through Catholic Charities, and it's a wonderful program, and I wish more people knew about it, and I'm hoping through your program we'll get the word out. There's just so many people out there that are caring and want to help, you know.
The interesting thing for me when I was researching Mary Jane was that it really isn't full. We keep hearing about these statistics, particularly with young women in their early 20s, which is now have now sort of supplanted what we used to believe about teen pregnancy.
Mm-hmm.
And knowing that this is happening, to think about a room going, you know, unoccupied mm-hmm. is a little odd.
Yeah, it's very sad to me. There's actually 6 rooms in the house, and currently there's 3 of us in the home at this point. There's been more or less since I've been there for the past 3.5 months or so. But, yeah, I look at those empty rooms and I'm like, why? I know there's more people that need help out there.
Because it was a choice for you to go there. You could have gone someplace else. But for you, you decided that having this baby was categorically what you wanted to do. There mm-hmm. was never a thought that you weren't going to have this mm-hmm. baby, although you were a little torn whether you'd keep him or give him up for adoption.
Right, yeah. So having this option for me, being able to be a mother to him in the capacity that I wanted, not having to worry financially about how I was going to be able to tackle the situation, especially, you know, with the father not being involved.
And he's made it clear he doesn't want to be involved at all?
He does, but he's married, and I wanted to respect his wife as far as that situation goes.
Well, she knows now, doesn't
yeah.
she?
Yeah. Yeah, and he wasn't being honest with her, and he never told her until I called the military and had them handle the situation. And I mean, because they're very strict about those kind of things. I just felt like she should know, and I felt that was, you know, only fair because they were getting ready to move to the mainland.
Are they gone now?
They were supposed to have left this past month, but with the investigation, I think they're being held up with that. So
what will you? Well, what do you hope will happen
with him? I guess I was kind of trying to decide whether I wanted someone like that around in my son's life. Someone having been so deceptive to me, my son's mother, how he would not be able to do the same thing to my son. And I just decided that, you know, that's not the kind of character I would like for my son to be around or to have an influence in his life. So I decided on my own that I didn't want that, you know, connection. And he's respecting that. So I'm appreciative.
Meanwhile, you are looking to carry on your life and maybe start a whole new chapter because you can only be at the Mary Jane Home for about 4 months.
Right.
And you've been there 3.5, so you're getting ready to outplace. What does life look like for you?
Well, I graduated nursing school from KCC this past December, And being a new graduate nurse in Hawaii right now is very difficult, and the tough situation all around. There's a lot of people that graduated, you know, maybe a year or two ago that are still having to work as nurse aides, try to get their foot in the door, so to speak. So financially, it'll still be difficult for me until I can get that position as an RN. But right now, I'm just trying to, you know, look at some opportunities and make contacts. And
is family helping you at all?
Emotionally and financially, my sister actually, she sends a lot of clothes for my son, so he's the best dressed baby in Kailua. But
well, I mean, that's stuff, but in terms of actual money, because you got to find a job pretty soon to do something, because you've got to support yourself.
I think we're all struggling financially in this economy, you know, so that was another reason why I didn't really want to try to lean on my family too much. They live out on the mainland in Georgia. Hawaii's my home, you know. I could have moved to the mainland and maybe perhaps made things a little easier on myself, but my mother lives in a geriatric community. There's not a whole lot of resources there. It's out in the middle of nowhere. I know that for myself to be able to thrive, I needed to stay here where I felt most comfortable and where I had, you know, made a place for myself.
You know? Well, we wish you all the best, and baby Ethan, too.
Okay, thank you so much.
Jenna is a young mother who opted to keep her baby and took up residence at the Mary Jane Home. It's a program of the Catholic Charities Hawaii organization, and it's for women 18 years old and older who are facing an unplanned pregnancy. The home provides a safe, supportive environment where women can prepare for children and work toward accomplishing their life's goals. And right now, it's only half full. For more information, go to our website, hawaiipublicradio.org.
Aloha, I'm Burton Richardson from Jeet Kune Do Unlimited. You're tuned in to HPR2 Hawaii Public Radio. Continue the conversation with us by following us on Twitter. Our handle is @HIConversation.
Earlier in today's show, we talked about the mamo, an extinct species of bird native to the Big Island. Avian malaria and the impact of Western contact drove it to extinction, but we do have remnants of its existence. Most of mamo feathers were black, but each bird produced 6 or 8 golden feathers. They were highly valuable to Native Hawaiians. King Kamehameha I's cape was almost entirely constructed of them. Weighing in at 6 pounds, the cape was pretty hefty. And today we asked you to guess how many mamo feathers were on it. At only 6 to 8 feathers per bird, almost 80,000 mamo were caught. Some stories say they weren't killed after plucking. But back to the actual number of feathers. If you've already done a quick calculation, you know it took about 450,000 feathers to make Kamehameha the Great's cape. And if you'd like to see what's left of the mamo, you can visit the Bishop Museum in Honolulu, where the cape is on display. That's today's quiz. If you've got one, send it in to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
Fran Nguyen Barker works in a studio in Volcano in the serenity of her Hawaii Island home. It's far from the world she left behind, Vietnam, in the years when it was torn by war. The search for peace is an important component of her work, and she has a new show at the Volcano Art Center called The Garden Within. She's with us by phone from the Big Island. Good morning, Fran. How are you?
Good morning. I am fine. Thank you.
The search for peace, I would think, would be both internal and external in your work, yeah?
Yes.
What was it like for you growing up?
right at the beginning, my earliest memory was the French soldier came into the village in North, and the priest would tell us to go to the church, take refuge for the women and children, go to church. And that's the earliest moment as a child of, I would imagine, 3 or 4. That's, and then later on, there was all the fighting. So we villagers around would come to my house because we have a brick wall, so bullets will not go through. So we would all huddle. If there's a bullet, the fighting begin, we would run in to sit together, a whole bunch of villagers and our family, just in one room because we have a lot of rice. That is in that room, so the rice and the brick wall will help from the bullets and anything that explosion, so we feel safe. That's my early memory.
An early childhood memory of bullets and explosion is a pretty, that's a pretty intense way to start out your life, isn't it?
Yes.
It doesn't strike me as an accident that you've ended up where you've ended up in a very serene, quiet, peaceful environment.
Yes.
Is that what
yes.
you saw?
So you can imagine kind of heavenly in volcano around the forest and ohia and lehua flowers and
yeah.
hapu'u. So it is heaven, really.
Well, that's what you were seeking, I would assume.
Yes, but in my studio, at any time, you will hear Gregorian chants, and you will hear a lot of Vietnamese song. Vietnamese song is either pre-war or after war. So anytime you hear songs about the war, so and then my memory, and I love these songs. So I am between war and memories of war and heaven outside. I left everything in Vietnam, whether south or north, wherever I was living, and come into this country to bring me back to those memory with family and land and motherland would be the songs. So
when
the
you,
song and the food bring me back.
When you say you left everything, Fon, you mean you left home, you left family, you left possessions, you started in America with nothing, yeah?
Yes, with a small suitcase and a couple set of clothes, yes.
And, you know, although there's a great deal of, and your new show is called The Garden Within,
yes.
and, you know, there are very lovely images in your work, at the same time, they probably wouldn't be the way they were if the war were not part of your background. Is that fair to say?
I think that's fair to say in one way that I think you will see a peace that console yearning. So that yearning for peace and quiet and soulful environment, be it relationship, be it relationship with friends, be it where I live,
mm-hmm.
that yearning is always there.
And so, and really what the, because I don't want to imply that your work has, you don't have any images of conflict and there isn't a great deal of tension in the work or anything like that, but I guess what the war did and the experience of your early life did was create that yearning. Is that, that's what I think I hear you saying.
I think you're right, yes.
So how does that yearning manifest itself in a you know, a visual piece without any words or anything to guide the viewer? How do you translate that into your work?
Well, actually, first of all, I don't have to be in my mind. I just have to follow my hand, and I just have to let that hand, that lead, the soul, the subconscious. You can say it in that way, or you can say the soul.
Sure.
You can say the spirit. Lead my hand.
Mm-hmm.
And that is, for me, to go is to start the painting with just let the hand lead the brush and put away my mind. And that's how all of my work started and end.
Well, it's been a pleasure to talk to you, and I'm really enjoying looking at your work. And it really does seem as if it's very, you can feel that immersion in what you're doing. Thanks very much for talking with us.
You are welcome.
Phan Nguyen Barker's art exhibit, The Garden Within, is on view at Volcano Art Center's Niaulani campus, and details are on our website at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for today's programming comes from Friends of Waikiki Aquarium, announcing the Kekani Oke Kai Summer Concert Series with Makaha Sons, Amy Hanaialii, Nathan Aveau, and more, Under the Stars at Waikiki Aquarium, begins June 13th. WAquarium.org.
Alex George hails from England, where he published four novels. Then he moved to Missouri and began writing about a fictional immigrant family.
First of all, I wanted to write about Missouri, because it's where I live, and because I think there's something quintessentially American about the place.
Alex George reads from his debut American novel, A Good American, next time on New Letters on the Air.
Tuesday evening at 6:30, following Marketplace.
Beth Ann, you talked with a young woman who's taken advantage of a resource available to young women with unplanned pregnancies, and that's a home where they can have their child and raise the child for the first few months in a, you know, an atmosphere of some support. And I was surprised to hear that there were still openings there. I know that there have to be young women out there who could be taking advantage of this program.
You are such a sensitive guy.
I don't know. I mean, are there? I would think there would be.
Well, apparently so. I mean, the reports that we've gotten over time is that the house is rarely full.
Yeah.
And yet we see the statistics of not especially teen pregnancy these days, but what's happened with early 20s young women who have gotten pregnant and deciding to, you know, raise a baby on their own. And unless they have great family support, at least it could be a place for someone to be for a couple of months. And it's not, as she said, it's not the only resource out there, but especially in this incredibly wired time where we think kids and young adults are so into what's happening out there, this stuff, just like the gonorrhea statistics, seems not to take their attention.
And, you know, so many of the resources are overburdened. It's unusual to hear of one that is underburdened.
Which was sort of our interest in all of that. Thanks for picking up on that. That's going to do it for us today. Up tomorrow, we're going to talk about the latest in Building Green. The Build and Buy Green conference keynote speaker will be joining us.
And we'll look at the inspiration that a life in dance can provide for a young IAEA student.
You can talk back to us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org or on Facebook at Hawaii Conversation, or even shoot us a tweet at Hawaii Conversation or at BecauseHPR.
If you want to hear today's show again, get another past show or links to more information, check the archive on the HPR website, hawaiipublicradio.org/theconversation. I'm Chris Vanderkut.
I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. We'll meet you in the morning for more of The Conversation.